listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Your mind may be preoccupied tonight with Greek debt or the Supreme Court ruling on health care, with student loans or unemployment, or you might go to sleep worrying about Guantanamo or the time Mitt Romney strapped his car dog carrier with his dog in it to the top of his car. And now the esteemed New York Times columnist Gail Collins is here to tell us we also need to worry about Texas. Gail Collins, as I'm sure you know, is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, and her column is essential morning reading for many households, including mine. We admire her bracing wit and her collegial voice and her uncanny ability to both interpret and skewer national politics. Gail Collins joined the paper in 1995 as a member of the editorial board, and in 2001 she became the first female editor. I don't know why that phrase sounds so odd, like first female editor, it sounds so clinical, of the New York Times editorial page. She is the author of several books, including When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. She actually spoke about that here at Aloud, and I believe you can find the podcast on iTunes. And her most recent book is As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. Gail Collins zeroes in on what makes Texas so important and why the country needs to know and care about what happened at the Alamo and what's happening in Houston. She makes clear that Texas is a hell of a place to be a corporation, but if you're a low-wage earning human, it's a quite different story. And as the late, great Molly Ivins once said, good thing we've still got politics in Texas, finest form of free entertainment ever invented. And it's a very good thing that we have Gail Collins to make us aware of how Texas politicians have recently been infecting the other 49 states with some very strange ideas indeed. I'm also very, very pleased that Ann Taylor Fleming is here tonight as our interlocutor for Gail Collins. Fleming is a nationally recognized commentator and writer. She joined CBS Radio as commentator in the early 1980s, and she held that post for 10 years. And at the end of that decade, she joined the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, contributing hundreds of essays on everything from teenage sex to the state of American journalism to the complicated role played by Hillary Clinton and the mirror she holds up to other women. She's received a 2006 Gracie Allen Award given by American Women in Radio and Television. Her work has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times and the New Yorker, and you can read her poignant, elegant essays each month in Los Angeles Magazine. She's the Associate Director of the Sun Valley Writers Conference and the author of three books, Motherhood.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. I just wish you could have all been backstage with us because we've just lit into everything, which we hope to do shortly here. And we're going to leave a good amount of time for questions because we feel that you've all come a long way and probably have a lot of them. This is our first time meeting. Feels like a long time.
We've been friends.
We've been friends forever. We're going to talk about Texas first. As I said to Gail before, I'm a little jealous as a Californian because we always had the profile and the stature and everybody was talking about us, but apparently not. It's now Texas.
Well, Texas is obsessed with California. And I've noticed California is not obsessed with Texas, so I've come to do something about that.
Exactly. And then we want to talk a little bit about the column and, of course, the canine celeb of the Romney dog.
Ah, Seamus.
You did it. Which we love, and whether, in fact, there is a war on women or not, which we will get to. Texas, why did it seize you? What is it doing? Why should we care?
I got interested in Texas in 2009 when you might remember the secession speech that Rick Perry made. It wasn't really a secession speech. It was a loud speech attacking the federal government in front of a large crowd of people waving secede signs, but it was not a secession speech. And he did say afterwards that it was a fine union, there was no reason to break it up, unless, of course, Washington continued on its evil ways, and then who knew what would happen. So I was not feeling the love that I as a member of the other 49, and I talked with people about it, and I was finally thought, why are Texans so angry? They have been running the country for the last 30 years. And I sort of went through all the things that have happened in the country that have been, to a greater or lesser extent, the work of Texas. And then somebody sent me a headline from Dallas that said, "Man allegedly beaten by frozen armadillo." And I just knew that I needed to go and see this. You know.
Had you spent much time in Texas?
No. This is totally an outsider's view of Texas. Poor Texans keep calling me up and saying, "But you don't understand the subtleties of..." And I keep saying, "No, I don't. You know, it's only what it means to the rest of us that I'm trying to figure out." You know.
Did it feel, when you got there, I don't like to use the word alien, but different?
It's different, but they're lovely people, I've got to say. And, you know, when I do things in the non-Texas world, especially in the north, people tend to get up and say, "Yeah, Texans, they're really dumb and they don't do it." And I point out in New York a lot that when Katrina hit, Houston took in 200,000 people. I'm not sure that New York, if Newark went under, would be prepared to take in 200,000 people. So, they're lovely people, but I grew up in Ohio, and I loved Ohio, but we never had T-shirts that said "Don't mess with Ohio," and you know the kids pledge allegiance to the Texas flag lit in the schools in the morning, and they take Texas history. And when I finished the book, one of the people that had helped me with it called me up, young woman, and said, "I never thought it was Memorial Day." And she said, "I never thought before that our custom of exchanging Texas flags on Memorial Day was unusual, but..." No, maybe it is. So there really is something different there. Not bad is in the people, but different.
You have a wonderful phrase which you talk about, an empty space vision, that this is what has, at the basis of the Texas mentality, as it were. I found that fascinating. You explicate a little. I like that a lot. I thought that was really, really smart.
I thought this before when I was in Congress, looking at congressmen, that the division in America has always been really between the people from crowded places and the people from empty places. And if you're from a crowded place, you appreciate government a lot because it's government that you can see every day making things work. It protects you if there's a burglar. It stops the sewer lines from exploding. It runs the schools. It keeps the dogs from pooping on the sidewalks. It does all this stuff. And if people in crowded places complain, it's usually about government not doing enough. You know, why aren't they keeping the dogs from peeing on the sidewalk too? You know, but in empty places, there's no point. You don't really see the point of government because you're taking care of yourself. The dog can poop anywhere at once. The sewers are not a problem because you've got a septic tank. It's the burglar. If it comes, you're going to shoot them. You know, it's just a whole different vision, and that's been true since Hamilton and Jefferson. But the difference now is that it's mental rather than actually physical. Texas has 26 million people, and 80% of them live in metropolitan areas. But virtually everybody in Texas thinks they live in an empty place. They really do, because it takes a long time to drive from one clump to the other clump, and but their vision is, and when you think that the world is full of empty places, it's very Tea Party. You know, the first, you don't need much government, and states' rights becomes a very big deal. So one of the things I tried to do in the book was to look at Texas to see what things it did that really were its own business, if it chose to do them, and what things sloshed over and affected the rest of the country. And there was a lot of sloshing going on.
We'll get to my favorite slosh, which is sex education.
It's always sex, isn't it? It really
but
is.
But well, California, you know. but start with the fascinating thing was the whole deregulation and the Enron and how, in fact, the ethos in Texas, which is, you know, no taxes, no regulation, and, in fact, something you call the enterprise fund, where they literally lure companies in with money, that in fact, has really sloshed over and maybe is, you know, really part and parcel of what has befallen all of us economically.
Yeah, I think I started with the savings bank crisis, the savings and loan crisis back in the 80s. That happened because, in large part, because the Reagan administration decided that when it changed the regulations for federally chartered savings and loans, it was going to follow the Texas model, because Texas savings and loans at that time were doing really well, making a ton of money. Nobody had noticed yet that that was because they were cooking the books on the Texas savings and loan. And there are so many things I love because there's a story attached to them one way or the other. I think my favorite thing about the savings and loan crisis was one saving and loan in Texas called Vernon Savings and Loan, which they referred to, the regulators, as Vermin Savings and Loan. But a ton of money was stolen and lost at Vermin. And the guy who was in charge was, of course, put on trial. And the trial broke new ground in that one of the defense arguments was that giving a prostitute to a bank regulator for the night was not a bribe if the bank regulator could not rise to the occasion. That was almost as good as the armadillo, really, you know. And then the other deregulation, the end of the wall between the commercial banks and investment banks, and the deregulation of the futures trading, and on and on and on. I mean, many, many, many people were involved in that. But one of the very biggest thumbs in the pie was Senator Phil Graham of Texas, who was the chairman of the banking committee, who I was particularly fond of because I was one of about six people in the world who was on the Phil Graham for president presidential jet for the 4 minutes that he was a candidate in 1995, before they all discovered that America did not want a president who said, "I do too have a heart. It's in a jar in my office."
That's right. I forgot.
But anyway, that was Phil Graham. And meanwhile, while he was doing that, Wendy Graham, who was in charge of the commodities regulation under George first George Bush, in her last days in office, ended her commission's ability to regulate the kind of future trading that Enron was doing, arguing that it wasn't really necessary to the great happiness of Enron, to the great dismay of California a little bit down the line, because I think most of you were there during the great brownout crises that followed. So that big Texas influence there with Wendy Graham and Phil Graham, too. And then No Child Left Behind, the federal regulation and organization of our public schools now is based on what George W. Bush experienced in Texas before he went to Washington. Nobody who was negotiating that bill that I could find said that there was ever a mention during the negotiations that one of the things anybody wanted to do was to allow private enterprise to have a great, huge chunk of the money that the taxpayers paid for public education. But that's what's happened. And coincidentally, the White House negotiator, who was an aide to George W. Bush from his Texas days, is now a lobbyist for Pearson, which is the world's largest private testing corporation. So I'm just saying. That's not
just saying.
And on and on. I'm sorry.
I've actually marked a few things here. The wonderful thing about reading this book is you're getting a lot of history, and you're getting a pretty good moral wallop, but it's all covered up with your humor. I've never read things out loud to my husband out of a book like this, so I've marked this particular passage, which you may not think as funny as I do, but I hope you do. This starts at okay and ends up right about there. I just thought you ought to have a flavor of her voice on the page.
I'll hear. Okay. Okay, back to the point. The answer, what the question I'd ask is that what the biggest outcome of No Child Left Behind was. The answer is education privatization. I know it's very difficult to move forward when the words education privatization get tossed out in the first six lines of a chapter. So my suggestion is you try to think of the privatizers in a fun way. I personally try to imagine a pirate crossed with a sanitizer, a guy with an eye patch and a carpet steamer. Keeping that in mind, let's consider what happened to public education over the last decade or so. More and more of your education tax dollars are going to for-profit companies. They write the tests and grade the tests, and if your child fails the test, they provide government-subsidized tutoring. If the poor kid really gets discouraged and drops out anyway, they're back with GED rescue programs. For-profits also run more and more of the public schools themselves. Really, pretty much everywhere you turn, there's a corporation with its hand out. Perhaps this is a welcome development, which will bring the magic of the marketplace to our overly bureaucratized educational sector. Or perhaps this is a case of our corporate entrepreneurs intruding into an area where the for-profit motive doesn't work and shouldn't be all that welcome. And just in case you were wondering, I'm once again going for the second option.
You know, what I love, though, is, I mean, you talk about this thing called the Texas Miracle, which yes. was the mm-hmm. which was the school, you know, all the testing, which we've now all seen. And but this is deadly serious stuff. I mean, this is really, we have followed. I mean, I really was quite stunned to the degree to which Texas has, if you want to say, infected the rest of all of the thinking at a very high level, right through the country.
And the interesting thing is when Texas started, Texas had terrible, 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 terrible schools into the 70s. And in the 80s, they tried to fix them. Ross Perot led a commission that went out and tried to figure out what to do with the schools. And because he was so very rich and able to buy a lot of lobbyists and so very crazy that he would say anything, he worked it. He did it. I think it was Ross Perot's greatest moment by far. And they came up with a reform that basically involved putting a lot more money into the schools. They reduced the size of the classes. They paid the teachers a lot more money. They started doing preschool for young poor kids as early as 3, I think. And things got better. Then they had to do it again because the poor districts sued because for the, I mean, it was just ridiculous. Some of the districts were like having $400 per student out of their property taxes, and others were having $80,000. I mean, it was just an incredible difference. So they had to fix that. They were under a court order, and they finally came up with another plan that just gave everybody a whole bunch more money. And once again, everything lifted. The kids started doing much, much better. Then the business sector, the more conservative politicians, said they wanted accountability. If all that money was going out, they wanted accountability. So the tests came in, which the people that started it in Texas didn't think were going to be, let's close down the school, let's fire all the teachers. They thought they would just be tests to find out who wasn't doing well in class so you could help them. But it snowballed. And suddenly you had this demand for accountability overlapping and then taking over the whole reform process. And it was no longer about adding more money, giving the schools more resources. It was about having more tests and more accountability and more punishments if the tests weren't good. And that's the thing that got transposed into the national system, and that's where we are right now.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about it. Gail also had a wonderful piece of this book in the New York Review of Books about the textbooks that are written in Texas and how they too have taken over the country. Yeah. You can riff on that. I have passages marked
but your intern came up to me before and said, I'd always wondered, there were such strange things in my textbooks, and I was wondering where they came from.
Texas.
You know? Texas. Texas has this very weird system. They have an elected school board that's elected in elections that almost nobody participates in usually. So it's very easy for very intense feeling people to dominate things. And suddenly, I just love it. They for a long time had a board member who believed that public education was a tool of Satan on the State Board of Education. It was just, you know, but so they go through, and because Texas pays for the school books for schools that take the books that the board recommends, and they usually recommend, I think, 4 per course, the publishers were desperate, because it's so huge, to get the Texas market. And, you know, it was so limited, the amount of, you know, the number of people who could qualify, that any time the board people suggested something, it was taken with, you know, great intensity. And, you know, all this strange, it was mostly strange stuff. And they'd sit there and say, well, don't you think it'd be a good idea if the National Rifle Association got more credit here? And, you know, you're talking about, you know, all the problems of the early cities. Don't you think there should be a chapter on the philanthropists among the corporate you know, magnates of the time, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the outcome of all this, and it's not as bad now, they've changed the system recently, but the outcome of all this, because Texas was such a huge market, was that many, many, many other school districts around the country wound up using books that had been deeply influenced by the Texas State School Board. And the end product was not a lot of error. They never did get their anti-evolution stuff in there to the credit of all the groups in Texas that lobbied against that. What they did was to make the books unreadable. Yeah. You know, I mean, they're all long narratives full of vague generalizations that wander all over the place, and then 5,000 boxes that have all the stuff that some school board member has suggested floating around all over the place. So the great, I think it's not so much that kids are studying creationism because of Texas. They're not, but they've got books they can't really read. And I asked one of the experts in Texas, well, if they can't read the books, and you tell me that the books are so huge now that the teachers can't actually get through the books, what do the teachers decide they're going to teach? And he said, well, it's the test. They decide based on the test. They teach the test. So once again, there you are.
There we are, Texas. I knew we weren't behind this in California. Okay, we're moving now happily on to sex education in Texas.
Yes, we're at sex, thank God.
You can just do this, because this is one of my favorite paragraphs.
Okay, sorry.
No problem.
Quite a bit of the information Texas students are getting seems to have arrived from another era. An abstinence-only program used in three districts assured them that if a woman is dry, the sperm will die, which harks back to colonial-era theories that it was impossible for a woman to get pregnant unless she enjoyed the sex. There are repeated suggestions that premarital sex could have fatal consequences, reminiscent of the 1950s legends about couples who had illicit sex in the backseat of a car and then they were murdered by the Lover's Lane maniac. I don't know if you ever went to Catholic school at that period, but trust me, the Lover's Lane maniac loomed large. A video used in three Texas districts has a boy asking an evangelical educator what will happen if he has sex before marriage. Well, I guess you'll have to be prepared to die, is the answer.
There are a lot of very good passages like
that. Can I tell
about
Speedy the Sperm?
Please.
That's my favorite. And some of a few of the districts, the poor teachers, the only time condoms come up is when the kids are told that they don't work. And in a couple of districts, the teachers are required to build an 18-foot paper mache model called Speedy the Sperm, which they then take around the class trying to demonstrate. Texas teachers go through a lot, I got to tell you. Trying to demonstrate that condoms don't work and don't, you know, protect you against anything.
Back to the campaign things that you were on. Did you hitch up with Rick Perry in his brief glorious run?
Well, yeah, I was certainly watching Rick Perry. He wasn't confiding in me at the time. And Texas has had a lot of really terrible. I mean, Phil Graham was the worst until Rick Perry came along. But in Texas, Rick Perry won his elections in Texas by fulminating against the federal government, because the point of being a governor to Rick Perry's constituency was not to make government work better, because government was not a good thing to begin with. Mm-hmm. It was to yell about how the federal government was persecuting you. So that's how he won elections. But he didn't debate. He didn't do any of that stuff. He never debated. He just sort of ran around.
Fulminated.
Those speeches and waving his hat, and his boots are named Liberty and Freedom. Personally, he has named his boots, but that's beside the point. I'm sorry, I just had to bring that up.
You point out that, in fact, the demographics of Texas, as in California, are certainly changing, that a massive chunk of the population is young, Latino, Asian. When will that be felt in a place like Texas?
Yeah, you ask the Democrats, the poor Democrats in Texas, oh God, they haven't won a statewide election since 1994. They're 0-99 on statewide elections at this point. I mean, they're just completely, except for some cities, they're just flopping, you know. And you talk to them and they say, oh, but yeah, but you know, the soon we're going to be a majority Hispanic state. And once that happens, our Latino voters are, you know, very Democratic, and that's going to be great, and yada, yada, yada. Which would be true if the Latino voters were voting in large numbers. Nobody votes in large numbers in Texas. They have one of the worst turnout rates in the country to begin with. And Latino voters vote less often than the Anglo voters do. And the mission, to me, the Texas Go thing, they're going to be the very big, humongous, growing, massively growing by leaps and bounds, second largest birth rate in the country. They're going to be the future. 10% of the people coming into the workforce in the future are going to be born, bred, and educated in Texas. And if they don't do a good job, we are all in a lot of trouble. And they're not doing a good job right now. And that's mm-hmm. the As Texas Goes thought. But one of the things, instead of working on this with diligence, the legislature is very busy trying to make sure it's more difficult for Hispanics to vote, or at least poor Hispanics, people who are nervous about going to vote anyway, they're making it more so. And my favorite factoid is that under the last law they passed, if you go in to vote as a voter ID, you cannot use a student identity card from a university, but you can use your gun carry permit. That's totally illegal. So.
And you can carry your gun anywhere.
Oh, well, yeah, but yeah,
that's old hat.
I've gotten over that one. I've spent so many years going around saying, you've got these guns everywhere. It doesn't do any good. You know, you've seen so many times that when something bad happens, nobody races up and shoots the person who's doing it. You know, people run away. But the feeling is so strong about how you're safer with a gun in so many places that I'm personally not prepared to argue about that anymore. I'm too tired. But Texas is also very loose in its gun sales laws. California is very strict in its gun sales laws. In 2010, I think it was, there were 368 crimes committed in California with Texas guns. So that's a slopping over. There's, of course, 15,000 crimes committed in Mexico with Texas guns, which has an effect on everybody, too. So that's another slopping over place, just like the educating of 10% of the workforce is something that slops over into everybody else.
Before we're going to go to questions in a minute, but can we do a little bit of the national scene? Can we slop into the presidential election?
If you insist. This is going to bring up the dog, isn't it?
I didn't go there. I didn't bring up the dog in every column. Now, you brought this, in fairness, and we're all deeply grateful to you for this. I said to her earlier, it's like the Where's Waldo book for children. You know, every time you see her byline, you say, okay, where's the dog? Where is he?
I have people come up to me often and say, why are you so picking on Mitt Romney about this dog thing? And many people that I talk to just feel very strongly that anybody who would put a dog on the top of the car just cannot be president, and that's all there is to it. My own personal feeling is, there they are, they're all here, yes.
You're lying.
My own feeling is that, I have to tell you that one time I was somewhere, and I know that President Obama believes that he would never put a dog on top of the car, but to be fair, President Obama could give Bo a helicopter right now, so I don't know that that's a really good... If Romney, when this first came up, had said, you know, I had 5 sons under the age of 14 then. I didn't know even where I was half the time, and it was clearly a bad plan now that I look back, but I was just in this vertigo of young boys, and I erred, you know, I'm sorry, that was the bad time in my life. Nobody would have held it against him. It was when he said that it was because the dog enjoyed the fresh
ride,
air.
That was it.
that we all went over the side.
Enjoyed the ride in the air.
Choice
of columns as you face a week, as you face the deadlines. I'm fascinated being a columnist. Do they choose you? I know that's sort of, do you choose them? How far ahead are you thinking? Are you seeing the whole week? Are you seeing 2 or 3 columns out? What's the rhythm of your thought and your writing process?
It depends. It's usually, if we can, we like to write off the news. I mean, all the columnists do. So that has a lot to do with it. Also, you know, some things do choose me because I just am better at some things than others. Whatever happens in Greece, it's not going to be me that's going to explain it to you. That's what we have Paul Krugman for, you know. Yeah. But, yeah, so to some degree, and Paul, there's a... yay, Paul. I have to tell you, somebody asked me the other night, you know, whether I didn't feel whether I felt bad about being so lighthearted frequently and so many bad things were happening. And we've got so many amazing columnists. I really feel that everything is taken care of, you know. Nick is always in someplace horrible, and he really likes being in places that are horrible, though, I have to say, you know, that he does. Nick Kristof is an amazing, amazing man. Yay for Nick. You know, I hired Nick when I was the editor. I was so pleased and proud of that in retrospect. But I used to get his expenses, and it would be like airfare, $12,000. Hotels, $4.37. It was like, he really can live rough. He's just amazing.
We were speaking earlier. You also hired David Brooks.
Yes, I did. I also hired David Brooks, who is just... You know, I do a thing with him every week. We converse online, and he is just a pumpkin. He is so sweet, and he's just the best person to work with.
Is there a war on women from the right side?
Oh. Well, there's certainly a war on women's reproductive rights on the right side. You know, it's always hard for me to tell how much things like women working anymore affect politics, because it's just so pervasive. And even, you know, the Tea Party people, most of them have working wives or are working women if they're women. So it's, I'm not sure it transcends everything. But the thing that's been interesting me during the last couple of years is that we went through a long period in which we acknowledged that there was a difference in this country about abortion. But we, I think, presume that contraception had been resolved. And it's just really clear to me that much of the abortion, anti-abortion sentiment is really extends to contraception in general. Mm-hmm. And that, I think everybody thought they had gotten past. So that part of it is a shock to me.
Yeah, I think it is to me too. I think we should open it up. You all look pretty champing at the bit out there. We'll continue to converse. So
we'll be talking among ourselves.
Yeah,
we can just go ahead.
People are out there with microphones. If anybody wants to stick up your hand, there they are.
Yeah, hi. I have a question. The question is, I don't disagree what you said about Texas politicians, but that state did give the country Ralph Yarborough, a very liberal senator, Jim Hightower, and a president who did more for civil rights than any president since Lincoln. More than Jack Kennedy, a lot more than FDR or Harry Truman or Bill Clinton.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. When we talk about the Alamo, which I was fascinated with in this book, I mean, because every Texas kid goes down there on a pilgrimage, and it tends to permeate in many ways the culture of the state, this idea of victory or death and taking the strong suicidal stand on behalf of things. And when I went to the Alamo, my two reactions were, wow, what brave men, and what a bad plan this was. It was just, why didn't they just go and help Sam Houston? They could have gotten out. You know, why didn't they go home and harvest the crops? But that intensity, that kind of need to take the great stand no matter what, I think is what carried Lyndon Johnson through the Civil Rights Act, which he knew was going to destroy the Democratic Party in the South. But I think it's also what carried Lyndon Johnson through the war in Vietnam. I mean, both the best and the most destructive parts of his presidential personality, I think, came directly from his Texasness. You know, the other great liberal leaders of Texas were from a very, really small strain of progressive Democrats. And I was talking to Robert Caro when I did the book about, you know, what his thoughts were about all this, because he was finishing up his last LBJ book. And he said that when he went back to Texas, most of the people who had been LBJ's Democratic colleagues had become Republicans, mm-hmm. you know, Connolly and people like that. And he said, and I knew that would happen, but he said they were such violent Republicans. I had no idea. And there is something about when the switch happened and all of the conservative Democrats moved into the Republican Party because of the Civil Rights Act, because, yeah. and frankly, because once the stigma of being a Republican went away, they were much more comfortable in the Republican Party than they had been in the Democratic Party. But they became violent Republicans, and that, you know, there still is a liberal strain in Texas, in Austin and Houston. And my good friend Marfa, my favorite town in Texas. A town in West Texas is named after a Dostoevsky character you cannot possibly not like, but there's lots of places like that. But the vast right now political temperature of Texas is Tea Party conservative. And there are moderate Republicans too, but they feel really outnumbered at this point in time.
I was wondering whether you think the New York Times has changed under a woman editor, and that what the climate is for women there, if it's changed. I read The Girls in the Balcony years ago, and Anna Quinlan recently, in talking about her book, has talked about women at the Times, and I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, if you don't mind, there's a thought that I'd like to share with people, because Freedom, when I used to do the women book talk, people would ask me about my own experiences and what, you know, I had encountered. They wanted me to tell my heroic story of overcoming great obstacles. And the fact was there weren't any, because I came in right behind the women who filed the suits at the Times. None of the women at the Times who filed the suits went on to great careers at the Times. The women who came in right behind them got all those advantages. And I know a lot of those women, and they are not bitter. They're bitter at the Times, but they're very pleased and proud and happy about what's happened to the women who came after them. And that, to me, is a definition of a great heart, somebody who takes joy in other people getting the stuff that they didn't get to get. And I mean, it's fine. I mean, at least my experience is, and I haven't heard any complaints from the younger women about sexism at the Times right now. And Jill's doing a great job of the paper, the news side, to the degree that I interact with them, seems very happy. Things are very calm down there. They're doing great stories. They're getting great, great scoops, and it's all good.
How much digital stuff is, where are they at? I know.
Oh, we are deeply digital. One of the reasons when I stopped being editor, you know, was that I told Arthur I could not go to one more meeting on our digital future. It was just, you know, but we, you know, we're doing great. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it permeates the place now, and I feel sorry for the younger reporters now who are out covering campaigns. When we used to do it, it was, you know, you'd be in the bus, then everybody'd file, and they'd go drink for 3 hours, and then they'd fall into their beds, and now they're blogging and they're tweeting and they're running around and they never get to do anything but work. But the deal that the Times has worked out with its readers as far as paying for repeat views over after the first 10, I think it is now, has worked out really well. Mm-hmm. And it told us something which we always heard, which is that the people who read the Times, wherever they get it, are pleased to help. I mean, people when I go around would always come up to me and say, I can't believe this is free online. I think we should be paying something for this. And now they are, and everybody seems happy. So it's going pretty well.
I wanted to ask you about Austin, the capital,
yes.
The weird Austin. Do you think there's stand a chance that kind of consider California even more so? They kind of consider California even more so. Do they stand a chance? Austin as a city, it is
Austin
different.
Austin is so, it's a very neat city. I mean, everybody kind of likes Austin. But I was in Macon, Georgia the other day, and a guy there was telling me that he had a new hire and from outside, and he was worried about him adapting to Southern pace and Southern lifestyle. And he said, do you think you can adjust to, you know, life in the South? And the man said with great indignation, sir, I have been teaching for 5 years at the University of Texas at Austin, and the guy said, well, Texas is not in the South, and Austin is not in Texas, so I don't know what that means, you know. Austin itself has a very mixed feeling about Texas, I think, sometimes.
As a former political journalist from Texas, I look forward to reading your book, but I was particularly interested, you just sort of glossed over, you said there are things that you're good at, that are more your beat, for want of a better term. And what would those be besides the dogs and driving beat?
I like to, if I have a mission in life, I like to think that sometimes I can explain things that may not be that fascinating to people in ways that they find interesting and amusing, that, you know, moves. I got started in Connecticut covering the Connecticut State Legislature. I cannot tell you what the odds are against anything written about the Connecticut State Legislature ever being read by anybody in the entire world. So that's when I started using humor. I mean, we also tried quizzes and poetry and everything else, but the humor worked the best. And I find it still does. I mean, you know, I tried the best I could to take this Texas stuff and present it in a way that would make people want to read about Texas politics when they're not from Texas. So that's my favorite thing. When I do that well, I'm kind of pleased.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you an ambitious question because I want to mix in a comment of David Brooks' article today, which is that it seems like what we're really talking about when we talk about Texas, which I would allege is in the South, is the Confederacy, patriarchy, violence of the few against the many, which David seems to think we should be following, was the theme of his article, that we're not good enough followers. So if the country is going the way of Texas, how do we contradict him and not follow if we read it that, you know, all of these military people, including all these presidents that came out of the South, and I guess we have to include Jimmy Carter, who was in the Navy, you know, have this tendency of patriarchy that springs from a Confederate impulse. And how does the New York Times get gritty about that in terms of the kind of particulars that you beautifully write about? I mean, you do bring it down to the kind of particulars in humor that grasp, you know, get us. So how do we get from here to there? And that's a huge question, but...
That is a huge question. Thank you. That's a monster question. Texas, to me, is more important right now than any other state because of its size, because of its relationship with its Hispanic population, which, although certainly ungreat on many, many points, is not crazy in the way that you find in, say, Arizona. I don't know if you remember watching the debates, the Republican debates, when Mitt Romney laced into Perry for the law in Texas that allows kids who were brought in illegally when they get old enough to have state residency status when they go to college to get the bargain on their college. And, you know, amnesty was thrown around quite a bit. And Perry was just totally befuddled. I mean, he was just like, because this was not a bravery thing for him. It was not a political courage. It was a bipartisan bill that the business community wanted. And he was just sort of stunned that anybody would think this was a bad idea. And that happened several times on immigration issues with him, because truly I do think Texas has the capacity on some levels to rise above and to really move its massively growing Hispanic population forward in a useful way for the rest of the country. It's highly unlikely, but it has that capacity. It's not a crazy, nutty state when it comes to this particular issue. So I'm going that far with Texas. There is a strong patriarchal tendency there, but there's also an incredible history of ridiculously feisty women in Texas that no man dare try to handle, you know, going all the way back to the earliest days of the state. There's a, I don't know if you've been in Austin, there's this amazing statue of this woman named Angelina Eberle, who was a boarding house operator, and there was a fight going on because Sam Houston wanted to move the Capitol from Austin to Houston, actually, where else? And he sent somebody over in the middle of the night to steal the state archives and take them to Houston. And Angelina Eberle saw them, raced out, fired the cannon in the middle of the city, rallied the city, saved and won the archives war, which is what they refer to it as. And the picture of her, she was this large, slightly with exposed breast, it does seem to me. But anyway, this very large, fierce, 7-foot-tall woman with her cannon out there. And that's a, there's a strong strain of that in Texas with its women. So, you know, I would take halfway through, I'm there with you.
I was curious about the Times editorial section's position on the second war in Iraq.
We don't talk about the how we get to the editor. I was the editor when we had the second war in Iraq, and usually when you have editorial board meetings, the editorial board is like, I think, 12 people now. It's been, you know, somewhere along that line all along. They're all experts in something. And when I was named editor, it was August of 2001. And my thought was, well, on the one hand, I don't really know much about foreign affairs at all. But on the other hand, nothing is happening on the foreign affairs front. And I can write in an interesting way about domestic problems, and this will be great. And then that happened. And I realized once everything had started, I had two guys on the board who had covered wars in Afghanistan. I mean, I was very rich in expertise. But you don't normally have that many fights on the board, but you could have sold tickets to the Iraq war stuff. And we, at the end, came out against the invasion, but it was very late in the game. And it was late in the game because we kept fighting about it, and I was torn myself because we all did believe there were weapons of mass destruction there. And what I wrote later was that my error was in listening all the time to the political people and the international experts and not enough to our science experts, who were much more dubious about that. And I am one of now the 200 people at the Times who has written something apologizing for something about the war in Iraq. But that, I'm proud about that at the paper. We do screw up, but I think we always take responsibility for it when we do. And the imperfection of our race to be against the invasion was my fault.
Hi. Texans do consider themselves a breed apart. And
yes,
as you were doing the interviews and even after the book has come out, have you had any backlash from Texans who felt that you were an outsider and really didn't have the capability to understand Texans?
Oh, much so. running from the guy who called me and said that if I ever came back to his state, he was going to stick a rattlesnake down my throat, to really sweet people who called, you know, and we went through long things about, you know, I agree in general, but you don't understand the subtleties of our state. And that's true. This is a totally outsider's view of what Texas does to the rest of the country. Texas has a trillion amazing writers, and I leave it to them to explain the subtleties of life in Texas to other Texans and to the rest of the country. I'd have to go back there for 20 years to be able to do a decent job of it. This is not that book. So that's where, but it, you know, it's a very, you know, all kinds of, poor people from Austin, you know, in Houston especially, you know, feel like, but we have a gay mayor, how can this be bad, you know? It's not subtle.
Well, I had a question, since you mentioned that you said that Texans have sort of a strange obsession with California.
And yes.
I spent a few years living in Austin about 20 years ago, and I remember at the time everyone there was convinced that everyone in California was going to move there. I never understood why, where they got this
so
idea
good,
from.
Yes.
Yeah, I was just curious if you had any idea or ran into that at all.
wonder. Well, now it's more from. They're convinced that every California business is going to move there. And you know, the lieutenant governor, your lieutenant governor, led a delegation there at one point to find out what Texas was doing right that that California was doing wrong. I could not get him to talk to me about this. So my just presumption was this was all about making Jerry Brown crazy, because it was a bipartisan effort to go to make California look bad, as far as I could tell. But there was one of the guys there, one of the state legislators from Austin, was in the group of Texans that were addressing this group, and he said, "I'd like to talk." I may be getting the name wrong. John Rawls, is that the name of the philosopher? He said, "I'd like to talk about John Rawls' theory of the disembodied soul," which was the first time that had ever come up in Austin, I swear to you. And he said, "And you know, the theory is it's one thing if you know who you are and you were here, but if you were just a soul floating around and didn't know what body you were going to wind up in, what different decisions you'd make." And he said, "If you were a soul that was floating around that knew you were going to be a software entrepreneur, maybe Austin or Texas would be the place you'd want to wind up. But if you thought there was a chance you were going to wind up as a quadriplegic, you would never want to go to Texas in a million years." And he was sort of going through this, and he said that the response was very bad. I can't believe they didn't say, "Wow, I can't believe we're having this conversation in Texas." But he said that somebody got up from the group and said, "You're talking about a welfare state," and just sort of stalked out. That was the end of it. But they do have a really special, Rick Perry has a special obsession with the idea of stealing California businesses. It's just his thing. It's so totally his thing. And I must say that people in California do not talk about Texas nearly as much as people in Texas talk about California.
We will now. Now that
Thank you. I appreciate
we will
that.
Now.
Yeah. I'm a public school teacher here in Los Angeles, and I can echo very much everything you've spoken about. To use the metaphor of the sloshing, has the tide just extended too far out for something to be done different?
Well, something is going to be done different, probably. It's just a question of what it is. The Republicans, you know, now have reacted violently against No Child Left Behind. Barack Obama is way more enthusiastic about it right now than, you know, any Republican that I know of. They hate it. You know, the problem really basically is if you decide you want no government interference and you want accountability at the same time, something is not going to go well. It's just not going to work out. Romney, we have a story today, you know, talking about what Romney's theory is. It's very mushy. I mean, I listened to his first education speech and I couldn't get anything out of it. But it seems as if people who are working with them are very big on vouchers, and that this may be where he's going, but he's never said the word yet. And I don't know if he ever will. But he's simultaneously calling for it to be less and also for it to be more, and I have no idea where his head is at. Really, none whatsoever.
I want to thank you for many times you've talked me down from the ledge politically, seriously. So I really want to thank you for
thank
that.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody.
And I'm not sure I'm happy to have another thing to be aggravated about as I am tonight with Texas. But I guess I want to know, since you do have such a light touch, what your feelings are in terms of optimism for the State of the Union.
Oh, you know, we are in a very bad place right now. I mean, everybody knows that. One of the great advantages of, I've written now five history books, and if you write about American history a lot, you realize how many awful, ridiculous places America has been in the past, and we do manage to get out of them. So I'm presuming that we will manage to get out of this one too as time goes on. I just know there's so many amazing people in this country, and I'm wowed every day by somebody I run into who's just doing something incredible. The story I was telling the night, which is this is a really name-dropping story, but I was at an event the other day. It was for this little tiny library on the Lower East Side that a school that was needed money, and I was there doing it because Gloria Steinem asked me to do it. Because Gloria Steinem spends every day of her life going to a fundraiser for some often obscure but worthy cause. I mean, and there's, you know, she could do anything she wanted to do, and that's what she's doing with her life. And there's a billion people like that out there in this country. It's entrepreneurially really good on so many levels. So you should have been here in 1890. It was really awful. We will overcome. I really do believe.
I think on that note we should end, because it can only
Thank
go
you
downhill.
Guys so much. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.